Welcome to The Rift, a radio show about climate change, ecology, politics, and power. My name is Roshan Krishnan, and you're listening to WEFT Champaign, 90.1 FM here in East Central Illinois and streaming all over the world at weft.org. Today is Sunday, June 1st, 2025, and this is episode 14 of The Rift. On the last episode of the show, 2 weeks ago, I spoke with Patrick Bigger of the Climate and Community Institute about the looming debt crisis in the Global South and the way that the structures of international finance, and specifically of climate finance, are skewed in favor of wealthy nations at the expense of poorer ones. Patrick gave a great overview of the kinds of financial arrangements through which this takes place, and he also gave some examples of what a more just and reparative regime of international finance might look like. And of course, if you didn't catch that episode on the air here on WEFT, you can listen to it or any other previous episode of the show by finding The Rift on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, or going to linktree.com/theriftradio. And I do recommend giving that episode a listen at some point, because today's episode is going to be something of a sequel to it. Now, it's no secret that there is a perverse disparity between Global North and Global South nations when it comes to the causes and impacts of ecological breakdown. The wealthier, more industrialized, and more powerful nations that comprise the Global North are responsible for around half of all global greenhouse gas emissions since the Industrial Revolution, despite containing less than a quarter of the world's population. However, the poorer, less industrialized nations of the Global South are disproportionately susceptible to the risks of climate change, a well-established fact widely acknowledged by the Global Climate Risk Index, the World Bank, and the United Nations, among others. In essence, the nations and populations that have contributed the least to climate change and ecological breakdown are suffering the most from its effects. As we briefly touched on in the previous episode, this disparity isn't random. It's the result of centuries of European imperialism and colonialism that shaped the nature of the Industrial Revolution, and with it, the origins of climate change itself. And this week, we're doing a deep dive on that very subject with Dr. Leon Seely Huggins, a sociologist focused on the global politics of climate change and senior campaigner at the nonprofit organization War on Want. After the break, you'll hear our conversation about how imperialism created a set of geopolitical relations that still affect climate negotiations, adaptation, and finance to this day. But first, programming on WEFT is brought to you in part by Make It Champaign Urbana, providing programs to assist new residents in getting connected to the community. The next New to See You Mixer will be Thursday, June 5th at May's Mexican Grill on North Chestnut Street in downtown Champaign. Meet other newcomers and community ambassadors from the Champaign Welcome Crew. For more information, please visit experiencecu.org/new-to-see-you. Programming on WEFT is also brought to you by the Champaign Park District. Enjoy live jazz music? The Champaign Park District's Jazz in the Park concert series is happening all summer at a variety of park locations. Everyone's invited to bring lawn chairs, snacks, and refreshments. The full Jazz in the Park schedule can be found at champaignparks.org. I can personally attest to going to some of these last summer. They were bangers. You should show up. It's cool. With that, here's my conversation with Leon Seely Huggins, senior campaigner on the Just Transition with the War on Want. I'm joined now by Dr. Leon Seely Huggins, a senior campaigner on Just Transition at the War on Want. Leon, thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks very much for having me and inviting me on.
Yeah, so could you just start by describing the general thrust of your work as it relates to colonialism, imperialism, the climate crisis, and a just transition, particularly in the Caribbean, but, you know, all over the world.
Yeah, absolutely. I've been working on climate breakdown as a topic of campaigning, activism, organizing, and also as research for about 10 to 15 years now. Completed a PhD about a decade ago. And in my PhD studies, I'm a trained sociologist, so I did undergraduate studies in sociology, a master's in social research. And then for my PhD, I wanted to look at the social dimensions of climate breakdown. So back when I started, and it feels almost ridiculous saying it because the situation has changed so much since then. But back when I started, there wasn't really much attention paid to the social and political dimensions of climate change, climate breakdown, I should say. There were quite a few brilliant scholars working in the field, but the field was a small one, to the extent that I could read all of the papers published on the explicit, like, sociological treatment of climate breakdown within, you know, a few days. Since then, I'm pleased to say that the climate movement, that scholars working in the field and others have worked to popularize the understandings of climate breakdown through a sociological lens. And what that means, I guess, is speaks directly to what my research has been about and what my campaigning has been about, which is that, you know, there are deep social and political implications of climate breakdown, both in terms of its causes and in terms of its effects. So when I was first doing the research, the main thing that was talked about in relation to climate breakdown, and this is something that as climate activists, we were keen to try and combat, was that climate change was understood as a problem of greenhouse gases, of CO2, of meters of sea level rise, of parts per million in the atmosphere, all of which is true, right? And degrees of temperature rise. That's all true. That is part of the story of climate breakdown. But it's only a part. And one thing that was neglected significantly was the question of what kinds of social and political structures produce the emissions, what kinds of behavioral patterns lead to particular outcomes in terms of excess emissions in some places and barely any in others. What kinds of social structures and relationships between people mean that some people, such as those in the Caribbean, where I did go on to do field work, are much more likely to suffer from suffer a disaster as a result of an encounter with an extreme weather event, rather than those in the UK, for instance, where, you know, the Caribbean has had a long and bloody historical relationship. So all those sort of social, political, historical questions were neglected in the field, and that was why I wanted to turn my attention to them, partly because they're interesting in their own right, partly because I think politically it was really important to start making the case that we can't just see climate change as this technical problem that's only going to get solved if we unlock the right techno fix, or if we best conceive the kind of measurement of parts per million in the atmosphere. That stuff might be necessary. In some cases, it might actually be a dangerous distraction, but I'll leave that aside for now. But it's only a part of the story. The other, and to my mind, more interesting and more engaging part of the story is to think about, well, why is it that some people are produced as vulnerable? They're made vulnerable. They're vulnerabilized. People in the Caribbean. And so I went to the Caribbean and was very generously hosted by a center in the region called the Caribbean Community Climate Change Center. They call it 5Cs for short. And from there, which is in Belize, I conducted my research, which included analysis of policy documents. So looking at how climate breakdown was being understood in the region, analysis of agreements, loan agreements, development aid projects, things like that, which showed a particular dynamic emerging in terms of how climate breakdown was being responded to by governments in the global north and through their and in their relationship with global southern governments. And also, whilst I was in Belize, I became aware of a really prominent issue around oil drilling and the designation of some parts of the country as, well, almost the entire country as protected area of one sort or another, whether that's marine protected area or forest or so on. And the Belize kind of case study, or the situation in Belize that people were facing, there was a mass campaign to try and stop or oppose oil drilling at the time. That kind of was a microcosm of a lot of the issues that I was observing in the wider Caribbean region. So a lack of resources domestically in Belize, a lack of resources in the Caribbean region to deal with the very widely known about impacts of climate breakdown, and therefore a population or groups of people made vulnerable by the fact that climate breakdown was rolling through the Caribbean in the form of more intense hurricanes, rising sea levels, changing weather patterns, droughts, and so on. So that's kind of my background, if you like. And since then, I've been working and campaigning on these issues in more depth. And most recently, I've taken up this role as a senior campaigner at the organization War on Want, where I follow the just transition negotiations through the COP, the Conference of the Parties, and also where I am campaigning for a globally just transition through trying to pressure the UK government and get the UK to change its practices through the corporations that operate out of here, and the fact that a lot of tax is avoided through the UK. The UK is a really important node of power whose actions have vastly outsized implications for people in regions like the Caribbean, which of course was once the former colony, and in some cases there are still overseas territories in and around the region and globally that belong to the UK. So it's following up on that colonial history and seeing how that structured the vulnerability of people in the present.
Great. Yeah, I'm glad you kind of gave an overview of the social dimensions of climate change and ecological breakdown, you know, and in many ways, that's kind of the entire premise of this show. And, you know, it's owed to the activists and scholars that, you know, foregrounded that lens. And before we kind of get into the specifics of talking about, yeah, the disparity of power between some of these nations and the history that's kind of constructed vulnerability, a gradient of vulnerability across the globe, as you say, you know, when I think about imperialism, which is, you know, one of the issues that we attribute this to, I generally think about Marxism and its associates, you know, Lenin's writings from the early 20th century, the concentration of finance capital, and its tendency to enrich itself at the expense of less wealthy countries. And then the way that that was built upon by the work of people like Kwame Nkrumah or Walter Rodney, who applied and expanded those ideas to analysis of their situations in Africa and in the Caribbean. So I'm curious how you understand imperialism through the years and today.
Yeah, I mean, I think I would trace my understanding of imperialism to a very similar, if not the same, lineage that you just outlined. And through the work of those scholars and others, I guess I see imperialism as a relationship of deeply uneven power between a kind of core and a periphery, and the core being one that uses military and economic and other forms of material and cultural power to dominate the periphery, and it does so for the benefit of extraction of wealth and resources to enrich the imperial core. So to take a specific example of the Caribbean, you know, the Caribbean was once an incredibly wealthy place. If you're to measure the wealth in terms of, I don't know, the unvalued labor of enslaved peoples, for instance, the value of unpaid labor in the Caribbean added percentage points, you know, a few percentage points onto the GDP of England at the time of England owning colonies in the Caribbean and English merchants and politicians and others kind of selling the fruits of those enslaved people's labor. So that was all part of the imperial regime. And I guess a key component of that is that the riches of the imperial system are often used to buy off a domestic population. So in Britain, for instance, you have me as a citizen of the UK, I benefit from some of the spoils of the imperial power. I benefit from a national health service, which is publicly funded, but which relies heavily on labor from former colonies to still provide care. So there's a kind of a brain drain, a sapping of resources from countries in the global south that were British colonies in order to prop up the British British domestic welfare system. And so I think that my understanding of imperialism is one that sees it still having relevance today, that it's still imperial dynamics and relationships still pattern and overdetermine relationships between countries, that still enable countries like Britain to remain very wealthy, one of the richest countries in the world, and to continue to capture wealth and extract wealth from the global south, despite the fact of formally technically having ended its empire, although as I mentioned there are still British overseas territories which are part of the empire essentially. So I think this lens of imperialism is a really important one for trying to understand that vulnerability that means that people in the Caribbean are unable to are less able to have access to the kinds of resilience building measures that they might need to in the face of climate breakdown. So, you know, despite Britain gaining points of its GDP through the trade in enslaved Africans, and despite the Caribbean colonies being so valuable that France was willing to sell the state of Louisiana to Britain as, you know, part of the Louisiana Purchase in order to keep hold of Haiti, because Haiti was the most profitable colony at the time that purchase was made. Despite all that wealth being generated, it wasn't kept in the Caribbean. It doesn't reside in the Caribbean. It's not there in the health service. The health service is largely private, or it's a patchwork of you know, voluntaristic and aid health provision. Nowhere near the standard of a country like the UK or even of France, who you know, owned Haiti at the time. So the importance of paying attention to imperialism is that it tells us that the reason that some people are vulnerable to climate breakdown now is because of imperial dynamics, is because of the extraction of wealth and resources over time, and the establishment in the period of the formal end of colonialism of a set of global institutional rules and regimes in terms of trade and finance and intellectual property and so on that maintain the power of the former colonizer countries at the expense of those that were colonized. So that's how I guess I understand imperialism, and particularly its relevance to the predicament of Caribbean peoples in the face of climate breakdown.
Got it. So that speaks a lot to the unequal distribution of vulnerability and the unequal accumulation of wealth across the world. And in some of your academic writing, you argue that the imperialist nature of the climate crisis is under examined. So not necessarily just where we find ourselves today, but actually the actual proceedings of climate change and the genesis of climate change and ecological breakdown, and the way that that's been shaped by imperialism. Could you talk about that a little, how imperialism has shaped the planetary ecological crisis from the start, and how that's contributed to where Caribbean countries and many other nations of the global south find themselves today?
Yeah, sure. So I think that what imperialism allowed and almost required was the expansion was the expansion of the countries who were building empires into parts of the world that were occupied often by indigenous peoples, but who then were ultimately displaced. And it required the movement of, as I mentioned, enslaved peoples, the movement of goods in order to facilitate trade networks that would further enrich imperial countries. And once the discoveries of the powers of fossil fuels to allow for industrial production were realized, Once it was realized how powerful fossil fuels could be in the process of industrial production, imperialism facilitated a series of exchanges which would enable the kind of burning of fossil fuels on a scale that was unprecedented previously. So you had a coincidence of the imperial conquest and plunder of countries with vast mineral wealth, for instance. You had the production of commodities through the exploitation of unpaid labor, indentured labor, exploited labor in colonies. And the wealth that was generated from that was often siphoned back into the imperial core and put into this project of fossil capitalism, the production of goods and services by manufacturing processes in cities like the one where I live now, which is Birmingham, which has one of the cities with a claim to being the place that started the Industrial Revolution. You know, a number of industrial, the first manufactory, the where we get the word factory from today, was in Birmingham. And these factories wouldn't have been, the development of these factories and the industrialization processes, which we now know have caused climate breakdown, wouldn't have been possible were it not for the vast wealth that was coming in to supplement the economic activity of the colonies, sorry, of the colonizer countries, of the imperial core from the colonies. So that's how imperialism is implicated in the unfolding of planetary crisis. And I'm focusing mainly on climate breakdown because that's my specialist area. But a lot of the, you know, the broader, we live in a planetary ecological crisis that's way beyond climate breakdown, species extinction, biodiversity loss, habitat loss, and so on. So a lot of those other issues in related ways or in parallel ways have the same genesis in imperialism, of over-extraction, of disregard for indigenous and non-Western ways of relating to and with the world, the material world, that also contribute to the wider planetary kind of an ecological crises.
Right. So a lot of your work has centered around the way that those power dynamics have manifested in contemporary responses to climate change. And, you know, in some of your prior writing, you've identified two of these vectors, the first being global governance institutions like the UNFCCC, the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, and the second being the distribution of climate finance and the enormous inequity in which that takes place, which I discussed a little bit a couple of weeks ago with Patrick Bigger. Could you talk about those in a bit more detail and the work that you've done on that?
Yeah. So when I was researching the situation of Caribbean countries, Caribbean people, and others on the front lines of climate breakdown, and why they were made more vulnerable, I had access to a set of documents that came out through WikiLeaks, which were a series of diplomatic cables that showed how diplomats, negotiators, ambassadors, foreign policy officials from various countries such as the US and the UK were working to try and twist the arms of countries in the global south, to bully them, to bribe them, and also to spy on them to try and get compromising information so that they could manipulate them in the climate talks. This was very naked. It was very explicit. They were saying things like, if Ethiopia doesn't sign up to our deal that we've tried to force through in Copenhagen, which was a climate agreement that was penned in 2009 at COP15, 15 conference of the parties of the UNFCCC. If Ethiopia doesn't sign up, then we will pull their aid. We'll threaten to pull their aid, and so we'll try and get them to fall in line that way. And if they don't respond to that, then we'll try and find evidence of a scandal that we can use to threaten their diplomats. And when I read these documents, I realized that the tools and tactics that were being employed through the UNFCCC, through this United Nations body, were actually, or rather, I should say, in line with the negotiating strategies employed at the UNFCCC by those countries in the global north. These tactics were, you know, totally akin to some of the tactics that we used under imperialism. They might have been less directly violent, but they were just as manipulative and showed a similar disregard for the sovereignty of the peoples in the countries that the UK and US and others were negotiating with. So there was a reproduction of imperial dynamics of power hierarchies through the UN, through the UNFCCC itself, where rich countries tend to get their way. The biggest funder to the UN is the US. The richer countries tend to put more money into the UN, and therefore it's not too many steps removed to be able to observe that they tend to get have a greater sway, and they also tend to be better at playing the media and information games, so setting the narrative and shaping the discourse such that they often are able to point the finger at other countries. Last year it was Saudi Arabia, the year before that it was India. Well, that might have been 2 years ago, sorry, in Glasgow it was India. So there's these power politics at play that were revealed through the WikiLeaks cables that show imperial dynamics existing even in modern climate politics. So that was one kind of one area where I was able to sort of research and demonstrate some of the continuation of imperialist dynamics in real time in climate politics. And then in terms of climate finance, I mean, I was in Baku last year at the climate talks, following the just transition negotiations, but the whole conference was overshadowed by the fact that rich countries who've had an outsized role in polluting and in contributing carbon emissions and causing climate breakdown, rich countries are refusing to pay up their historical climate debt. So when it comes to debts that are owed by global southern countries, such as Sri Lanka, such as Pakistan, such as Namibia, such as, I mean, you take your pick, there are 48 countries where who spend more on debt the interest on their debt repayments than they do spend on health and education. So there are tons of countries who are seriously indebted. When it comes to making sure that their creditors are paid, global northern countries are very good at making sure that that happens. But when it comes to paying up their own climate debts, the debts that they owe to the global south, to peoples on the front lines of climate breakdown, because it's countries like the UK and the US and EU who have emitted far beyond their fair share of emissions and taken up far beyond their fair share of the planet's capacity to absorb carbon and its atmospheric space. When it comes to those debts, they're absolutely unwilling to budge. Again, the fact that they can just totally ignore the demands to pay up for their climate debts is because they are still major imperial powers. They hold more power than those smaller countries or those poorer countries who are kind of forced to make these demands, but with no material means to back up the demand. Whereas, again, we know that the US, particularly under the current administration, will threaten to use military force. Or the UK has a long history of using military force. I was reading an article about how the UK backs up the Sultan of Brunei in order to maintain the Brunei Shell kind of joint venture, which extracts oil there and which enriches the Sultan of Brunei, makes him one of the richest heads of states in the world, and allows him to pay for British army troops to be permanently stationed in the country. So I said generally there tends to be less of this overt military power, but it's still there as well. If you look, there are countless examples of it. And another one would be in Israel and the genocide that's taking place there against the Palestinian people. So the imperialism is in some ways a bit more hidden. I think the extent to which it's a direct form of control and there are lots of indirect measures such as manipulative climate finance agreements, which include clauses that countries should open up their economies to companies from the global north, that they should remove their welfare spending in order to gain access to the loans that richer countries are offering, that they should accept loans rather than grants. And those are all kind of less direct forms of imperial power, but the direct forms are there as well when those fail. And you see that through invasions, you see that through the size of armies and the access to weaponry. So yeah, the climate finance issue, as we saw it at Baku last year, was a really good demonstration of this, that countries from the global south were demanding a $5 trillion down payment for, or movements from the global south, rather, were demanding a $5 trillion per year down payment on climate debt. And the figure that was arrived at was actually $1.3 trillion, and it's actually not even $1.3 trillion. When you adjust for inflation, it's less than the $100 billion that was offered back in Copenhagen at the COP15 over a decade ago, almost two decades ago. So this is all imperial power on display, the ability of rich countries to just ignore their debts, and yet at the same time for them to enforce the payment of debts of poorer countries.
Yeah, I mean, while you were speaking about that, it did make me think about my conversation with Patrick a couple of weeks ago, and the arc of imperial power, and this is something that you got at, is kind of fascinating in that a century ago, or you know, more recently, you had actual boots on the ground settler colonialism. Then you sort of start to move into this area of structural adjustment, where you had very strict imposition of conditions on loan activity, and you know, the taking a pickaxe to these countries' welfare states. And now we've moved, as you said, into an era where the more visible elements of imperialism are a bit of a softer power, or a lighter touch, but with no less deleterious effects. Do you think that that's a result of growing movement activity or opposition or the results of decolonization? What do you think has caused that sort of adaptation in strategies from imperial nations?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, I'm not sure would be the short answer, but I think definitely it accompanies the kind of rise of neoliberal forms of capitalism, the move towards more financialized forms of power. I think there's a way in which, just as it was deemed to be more efficient financially and economically to do away with enslavement, partly through the resistance of enslaved peoples, which made it less commercially viable, but also partly because of the realization by early capitalists that they could make more money if they exploited people through wage labor and, you know, shifted certain kinds of factors of production around. Just as that shift happened, perhaps it's realized that it's easier to rule countries, or to not necessarily rule them, to hold influence and power over countries by not directly ruling them, as you might do under imperialism, but by having their commercial and economic interests tied up with yours, or rather tying up their commercial and economic interests with those of your corporations, your powerful lobby groups and sectors. So I think there's been it's an efficient move that you don't have to directly rule a territory. You just tie them up in legal and political arrangements that allow for the kinds of extraction that you would have liked to have employed anyway. And partly, as you said, the power of movements for decolonization and for the independence of states and regions. And of course, this year's the 70th anniversary of the Bandung conference, and the you know, the forming of groups to try and assert a kind of south-south alternative model of development. And that was crushed through a combination of direct military violence, you know, with the US sanctioning coups, invasions, and other things, including the UK's involvement, right up until very recently, you know, where it's been documented by a brilliant UK research and media organization called Declassified that the UK ambassador was kind of directly implicated in the plans to oust Evo Morales from Bolivia, all of which centers around the new kind of frontier of imperialism, if you like, or a contemporary frontier, which is the scramble for transition minerals and the efforts to try and steal a march or gain ascendancy in the next industrial revolution, the transition to a post-carbon economy and society. So I think there's a sense in which it it was forced upon imperial powers that they had to relinquish control of territories because those territories made the people in those territories made themselves ungovernable. But also, there was a moment that came about, you know, with the Washington Consensus, whereby powerful countries and actors within those countries could still shape the global economic architecture in their interests through, yeah, the conditions that you mentioned, such as the neoliberal era structural adjustment programs and so on, through the bodies like the World Trade Organization, through the IMF, the World Bank, through the control of economic activity via the dollar, dependency on the dollar, that all these different measures kind of achieved a similar outcome of enriching the imperial core without necessarily having to always use explicit military violence.
Got it. And on that note, you know, we've seen instruments devised by some of these global governance institutions to handle climate change or ostensibly handle climate change. Things like the Clean Development Mechanism, which was a sort of carbon offsetting program that, you know, ended up mostly just giving a license to global north nations to continue polluting while constraining the sovereignty of countries that implemented these offset programs, as well as the Green Climate Fund, which again was supposed to be this sort of financing mechanism for so-called developing countries, and really was just sort of underfunded and used as exploitative leverage from the start. Essentially, these programs have done kind of what you've described and ended up sort of reinscribing colonial and imperial relations. And so I'm curious, you know, I know you've been doing some work on current initiatives like the Just Transition Work Program, and I'm curious whether you think things like that have any potential to be a vehicle for reparative climate finance, or whether it's kind of another go around on this cycle of imperialism.
Yeah, I mean, I think if we're going back to your opening question, and you know, you're tracing the lineage of imperialism as a concept and the influences of it. I mean, I think if we're to learn from those scholars and activists who give us some of the best the best tools to understand imperialism, they emphasize the fact that this is an open question, that it's through struggle and resistance that we are able potentially to undo imperial dynamics and force the hands of those who owe reparations to pay them, those who need to relinquish power in order for us to enact reparative justice, to relinquish it. So I think it's an open question whether or not the new initiatives like the Just Transition Work Program, the Loss and Damage Fund and others will be able to achieve some measure of reparative justice. I think, you know, we should be hopeful about our power and the fact that when we are united in struggle, we are able to achieve significant things with our power. But we should also be, you know, I guess, honest about where these initiatives have come from, the wider context within which they sit. So the fact that the UNFCCC is very stacked in a lot of its processes and procedures. You know, the US can bring a team of hundreds of lawyers, loads of lobbyists, and so on, whereas a lot of small island developing states might have one negotiator to go around a number of different agenda items, and they're having to rush from room to room. They don't have a back-end team of anywhere near the same scale. So the odds are stacked. But having said that, when civil society, you know, grassroots groups demand something and fight for it, and we put our bodies on the line, we put our efforts into struggle, we can win and secure victories on these issues. And in terms of the just transition fight, one of the interesting things is that, yes, on the one hand, the dynamics that exist within that area are that the global northern countries are all saying, well, we're doing just transition anyway. We'll tell you guys in the global south how to do a just transition so that your workers aren't left behind as we transition away from fossil fuels. And then global southern countries are coming and saying, well, look, actually, we don't have that many workers in those sectors because we haven't been doing that much sort of fossil fuel based development generally. I mean, there's obviously a complicated picture there around some countries in the global south that have, but generally speaking, especially the most vulnerable countries, And then they say, and besides, we don't have the money to set up a just transition commission or to make sure that workers have access to the tools to be retrained, because we don't have money for our welfare state, let alone for, you know, this luxury of a just transition. And so I think one of the things that we've been trying to fight for is the idea that, yes, the rich countries do have a responsibility to pay for the just transition in the global south, a disproportionate responsibility, because they caused the problem in the first place. So there's a moral case, an ethical case, and just a practical case that global south countries can't afford to do just transitions without those resources. And that's the fight. So in terms of, the potential, I think the potential's there. The just transition as a concept has a lot of mileage because it's relatively well agreed, although this consensus is being unpicked, you know, as we speak, in terms of the actions of President of Argentina, Milei, Presidents Trump, the election of reactionary presidents internationally, who are going against this kind of what was once relatively settled agreement that climate breakdown is a topic that needs attention and we need to transition away from carbon. But the extent to which there is still a consensus, then countries do believe that they need to make sure the transition is popular. Otherwise, they won't get support for it. And part of making it popular is making sure that people gain something. They don't just lose out. So you're not just shutting coal mines and telling people that they don't have anywhere to go. You're offering some other kind of package in response. But for us at War on Want, our vision of just equitable and ecological transitions goes way beyond just workers affected indirectly affected sectors of the fossil fuel industry. It's about, you know, fighting for a global Green New Deal, fighting for the rights of countries in the global south not to have to be bound by the corporate trade agreements that mean that they can't decide to stop extracting coal and oil and gas because there's a British company who says that they've got to continue mining, even though it's not in the interests of the local people in that country, or it's not in the interests of the planet to have those fossil fuels mined. You know, that just transition is also about valuing care and care work and seeing the role of that care plays for the essential survival and dignity of every human, irrespective of their life stage, and having that recognized as an important or a key part of any transition, or about cancelling unjust and illegitimate debts, or making sure that inequality is addressed so that there's not this such an extreme gap between those who are at the very top of the pyramid who own, you know, the top 1% who own more wealth than the bottom 95%. It's about flattening that inequality so that everybody has access to the resources that they need to live. So for us, the just transition is about the transition away from carbon and climate, but it is also about, as you said, like reparative justice. It's about making sure that people have the resources that they need to live fulfilled and dignified lives in the face of these imperially produced historical inequalities and harms. And it's about undoing those harms and repairing them. So we'll fight for that, and we'll see if we win that. But certainly it's a possibility. It won't, if we win it, it won't come just through the Just Transition Work Program at the United Nations, because, you know, that for all the reasons that we've talked about in terms of these international institutions. However, at the moment, for a lot of countries, especially those in the global south, the UN is the best space they've got to fight for these things, in relation to climate, until or unless, you know, other forms of institution are built and developed to the point that they can create, a better form of alternative power and counter power.
Yeah, on that note, how do you see global movements responding to these current conditions? And, you know, maybe you could describe a little bit more about what you're doing with the War on Want and the sort of idea of the global Green New Deal that you are pushing for.
Yeah, I mean, I think global movements are united in wanting meaningful climate action. There's been some really interesting polling that goes beyond those who would consider themselves, you know, movement activists or movement actors. It's just sort of a survey of the general public, and it shows that 89% of people surveyed, I think it was a survey of 77,000 people in over 80 countries, 89% of them wanted more intense action on climate breakdown because they recognize it's this existential threat. It's not the people who are the blockers to this, although that's the story that you'll be told by, you know, media, is that like, oh, people don't want climate measures because they're too costly. No, climate measures are only costly when you view them as climate measures, rather than viewing them in the lens that I described at the beginning, you know, of being also about equity, also about historical inequality, also about living a dignified and fulfilling life. When people are presented with climate action that is also action to make their, you know, the waiting times that they experience for healthcare, or the quality of the education that they need for their families, when these things are all seen as part of the same package of climate action, which is what our vision of a global Green New Deal is, people are incredibly supportive, because it's just a better world for them. And there's only a tiny percentage of the world's population who stands to lose out from that version of climate action. And that's, you know, the 1%, the billionaires who are trying to reshape the world in their image, who also, by the way, acknowledge climate breakdown, but they have a very dystopian and selfish vision of the response. The response is, we're not going to do anything to arrest it, for the most part, although they used to say that, but now they're abandoning even that. We're going to allow it to continue, but we're going to make sure we have a bunker in New Zealand, or, you know, in Midwest Canada, or wherever it is, and we're going to make sure that we've trained a private army, and we've got adequate water supplies and desalination plants and so on, so that we can survive and wait out the apocalypse. Well, I've got a sad reality check to present to these guys, and it is usually guys, disproportionately guys, overwhelmingly men. That vision of a world isn't a world you're going to want to live in, even if it were possible for you to live in it the way that you're imagining. Like, there's no meaning in that world, and it won't work, because who are you going to be? How are you going to rely on? Who are you going to rely on for the things that you need to make your life livable? You know, you might have your own private chef, but you know, that the workers that you manage to hole away with you in your private bunker might decide that actually it'd be much better for them to kind of collectively own whatever resources you've hoarded than for you to hold them on your own. And much better, much more appealing to the majority of the world's population is the vision that we have, which is one where everybody has the right to live in harmony and dignity with the planet, that we don't breach further planetary boundaries, that we repair the harms that have been done both to people and to planet, that we make sure that everybody globally has access to, you know, healthcare, education, a decent income that allows them to live a satisfactory life, that people have political power over the decisions that affect them, rather than being at the whim of, you know, corporate CEOs or corporate boards in some far off boardroom. And I think, yeah, that's the vision of a global Green New Deal, and that's, I think, a vision that's very appealing to movements all over the world, and to just ordinary people who aren't even necessarily activists. I think people know that the world is quite screwed and they want it to change. They're just often told and lied to that it's not possible to change, or that it's too expensive to change. And they're being told those lies by those people who stand to lose the most from the change, but who have, who have monopolized the kind of means of communication and narrative setting.
Well, as we approach the end of our time here, is there anything else you'd like to close with, or anywhere that people can follow your work as you continue on these efforts?
Yeah, I mean, I would say we're a UK-based organization, War on Want, but you can sign up for our email lists, and certainly you can follow our work on Instagram, on Blue Sky. We have a website. We're about to launch a huge Just Transition briefing, which goes into more depth on a lot of these issues. And alongside that, we'll have a shorter version, a shorter, more accessible briefing. So people can follow our socials to keep an eye on that. I occasionally post on Blue Sky, at pro.social, I think, pro-social. And I have a link tree, so people can follow that if they want to. Perhaps you'll be able to link to it in whatever notes come with the show. But yeah, we're just going to be working to fight for a just transition, both at the COP, but more importantly, on the streets and in our workplaces and in our communities. Until we secure it.
Absolutely. Well, Dr. Leon Celia-Huggins, thanks so much for taking the time to join me today.
Pleasure. Thank you.
That was Dr. Leon Seeley Huggins, sociologist and senior campaigner with the nonprofit organization War on Want. I want to thank Leon again for sharing his expertise with me, and I hope that this little semi-planned two-episode series on global climate politics has served as a useful primer on the political landscape and history underpinning the planetary ecological crisis, and the reason why it really is necessary to understand the past and present of colonialism, imperialism, racism, the project of the nation state, all of these very human socio-political constructions that are part and parcel of the crisis that we're now staring down the barrel of. Just on a personal level, this particular subject has been integral to my own understanding of ecological crisis. And, you know, I opened the very first episode of The Rift by saying that I wanted the show to be about the social and political dimensions of ecological breakdown. And in that way, as I said to Leon, the show really is an outgrowth of the research and activism of people like him and brave activists all around the world who have worked very hard, sometimes at threat to their own lives, to foreground these issues. And I can't stress enough how important it is to support and join those efforts if we want to have a chance at global ecological justice. So certainly I would encourage folks to follow the work of War on Want and to continue digging into global climate justice efforts, as I'll try to continue sharing them on the show here. But as for today, that is all I've got for you. As always, thank you so much for listening to The Rift on WEFT 90.1 FM, community radio from Champaign, Illinois. The recording of this episode will be online later this evening. And up next on WEFT, we got some tunes up until the top of the hour. And then, as usual, it's On the Move with Herbert Burnett. The next episode of The Rift will be on Sunday, June 15th. We'll see you then.
midnight's the night, everything changes. We're born at midnight, dressed in black. Open up those double doors. Make me a drink, now it's time to dance. And she looked out into the night and said, she looked right into their eyes and said, come on. Out of nowhere the music stops. The lights come on, I'm slammed against the door. I hear him yell, let's slice it up. We'll bust some heads and we'll be home by four. And she looked out into the night and said, she looked right into their eyes and said, come on. Tonight's the night, we won't disappear. Red sparks are flying in this hot summer air. We're never going back, we're taking our streets. Call everyone you know, tonight's the night to be free. Light it up, bottles are flying. Use the alley if they won't let us pass. We're not wounded little kids anymore. Time stand still, there's beauty in this shattered glass. And she looked out into the night and said, she looked right into their eyes and said, come on. Tonight's the night, we won't disappear. Red sparks are flying in this hot summer air. We're never going back, we're taking our streets. Call everyone you know, tonight's the night to be free. Tonight's the night, we won't disappear. Red sparks are flying in this hot summer air. We're never going back, we're taking our streets. Call everyone you know, tonight's the night to be free.
We are WEFT Champagne, 90.1 FM. Your community radio station since 1981.
Hear that lonesome whippoorwill. He sounds too blue to fly. The midnight train is whining low. I'm so lonesome I could cry. I've never seen a night so long when time goes crawling by.